So today I would like to report on some recent progress in the renormalization program for tensorial group theories. And this is work in collaboration with Daniele Rodetti and Vincent Rivasso. So let me first give some general motivations for this work. So tensorial group theory is a generic name for both tensor models and group theories. And as such, they can be motivated by two complementary approaches. One started with the matrix models that were used to define 2D random geometries and as such study quantum gravity in two dimensions. And they have been generalized to higher dimensions to address the question of quantum gravity in higher dimensions. Already in the 90s, but the progress on this line was very slow due to a lack of analytical tools. And you know very well that recently, thanks to the work of Razvan, these tools could were suddenly available, and progress has been fast on this line, up to the point that renormalization tensor field theories could be defined by Joseph and Vincent, for example, quite recently. Okay, and the complementary point of view on this this tensorial group field theory business is of course the group field theory approach, which is a tentative framework for giving a full definition of spin four models. So you know that spin four models have something to do with the quantization of simplicial geometry, and that they associate amplitudes, that is numbers, to triangulations of spacetimes with given boundaries, and the fact that these amplitudes are not independent of the triangulation that is used to interpolate between different boundaries requires some lattice gauge theory limit, or alternatively to average over these possible combinatorial choices. And so the group theory is a prescription for the second strategy, which builds on a quantum field theory formalism by interpreting spin form amplitudes as really the amplitudes of a quantum field theory. And so this quantum field theory then provides some weights, some measure on these combinatorial structures. So in this approach, a generic question to address is, of course, that of divergences. And that's the aim of the talk. I would like to show how renormalization can be generalized to such quantum field theories, which are not defined at spacetimes, but to really understand the divergences. And a second motivation, complementary to this one, is that in these approaches, we are quantizing simplicial geometry, and a big open question is how will we recover the continuum limit for such discrete theories of space times, and this is a big question we would like to address in tensorial group field theories is whether we can define the well-behaved quantum field theories of these types, that is, theories which are renormalizable, and if we can identify a regime in which the discrete geometric data looks approximately continuous, and if so, if we can also analyze the classical limit and ultimately, hopefully, recover GR. So that's the big question, just to put some perspective, and of course, I will not answer it. So the purpose of this talk is more modest, of course. It's so I will try to review a bit the state of the art in the this renormalization business. And so we already have since 1 year ago like several models of this type that are renormalizable, and on top of that have been shown to be asymptotically free. That's a very good sign for supposedly UV fundamental theory. And the idea would be to, from these models, successive models, is whether we could bridge the gap between these simple, purely combinatorial tensorial models and the richer sets of spin-fo models, where you have additional discrete geometric data associated to the combinatorial aspects of the theory. And so I will try by presenting to you a recent model of the boulette of type defined on the gauge group SU2 and in three dimensions. So we hope that it might be related to quantum gravity in three dimensions. I would like to try to convince you that in principle it should be possible to analyze more complex spin-fo models with this formalism. At least if we allow ourselves to work with non-trivial propagators, which are not projectors, and if we correctly identify a subset of foams that can be that reproduces itself in a sense, and I will explain what I mean by that, and also complementarily. So while we have to modify the spin form aspects, we will also have to generalize some QFT notions. And one of them is the notion of locality that is so important in space-time-based quantum field theories. So the model I would like to present is really similar to the Bulatov model for 3D quantum gravity. So I will start by giving a blitz review of the Bulatov model. Then I will enlarge a bit the class of models that I would like to consider. I will define them, and we will look at the particular case with the group SU2. So first, let's start with the Bulatov model. So this is a rather old spin-fo model that has been defined by Bulatov in 92 and aims at quantizing 3D gravity. In Euclidean signature. So the basic field of the theory is a scalar field, a real one, based on three copies on SU2. And this field is required to verify some gauge invariance condition, which I show here in equation one. And this condition is what allows you to interpret this field as a quantized triangle. And so the idea is then from these quantized triangles to generate, thanks to the quantum field theory formalism, higher dimensional complexes constructed from these quantized triangles. So this is done by defining a partition function in equation four. And this is an integral over the set of invariant fields invariant to the in the sense of equation one, weighted by an action, and the kinetic term, the original kinetic term used in Bulatov formulation, is a trivial one. That is, you just have a convolution of two fields along their common arguments. So you should interpret this convolution really as an identification of two quantized triangles along their common edges. And the interaction part in equation three is now a convolution of four fields, so four triangles, aiming at representing the gluing of four triangles along their common edges, so as represented in the T-tray drawn on the left side. Okay, and now when you expand such a theory with respect to the parameter lambda, the coupling constant, you generate a sum, a weighted sum of amplitudes, and these amplitudes are labeled by spin foams, by two complexes, which are dual to the two triangulations. So the elementary building blocks of the triangulations are the tetrahedra, represented by the interaction. And the weight associated to each of these triangulations is the Ponzano-Leger weight, so given by the Ponzano-Reggie spin formula. So that's the link with spin formulas. So in this original formulation, there are a few issues that I would like to review because they're important for the following, the rest of the talk. One has to do with the combinatorics or the topology of the forms summed over. And so not only the theory generates all possible topological manifolds, which is kind of a nice aspect of the model, but also very singular topologies. And when I say very singular, I mean very, very singular. That is topologies where the local structure of spacetime is not recovered at all. So, and okay. And this the reason why this happens is essentially because the two complexes on which the amplitudes are defined do not capture the full topology of the triangulation they aim at representing. So there is a mismatch between what we would like to generate and interpret as a discrete spacetimes and what we can really control thanks to the two complex. And the second point that is crucial to address is that of divergences, because the model is not convergent. We need to regularize it, and a way to do it, for example, is via equation 5, where the delta functions defining the trivial propagator I talked about before, that is the kernel of the interaction part of the action. You should replace these delta functions by heat kernels, that is functions picked around the identity on the group with the width given by the parameter big lambda in equation 5. And by doing so, when you send lambda, big lambda to zero, you can look at the structure of divergences, and many papers have been published on this line. And a recent one, which summarizes a bit all we know about it, is that of Valentin and Matteo. And the complicated aspect of these divergences is really that they not only depend on topological quantities, but also on the combinatorics of the foam. So there's a non-trivial interplay between the complexity of the foam and its topology. So this is very different from the matrix model case, for example, where only topology matters in the end. Okay. So to address these two complementary open questions, a big step was made by Razvan when he introduced the so-called colored version of these models. And the prescription is pretty simple. Instead of looking at a theory defined with one unique scalar field, you choose a similar theory but defined for four scalar fields. And the prescription is that now the interaction, the simplicial interaction, is not an interaction between four identical fields, but four different fields, labeled by four different color labels, the 1, 2, 3, and 4 in equation 6. And so this prescription doesn't change the relation between the amplitudes and the Ponzano-Reggie model. You still have amplitudes associated to simplicial two complexes with the weight given by the Ponzano-Reggie model. The only difference is that the sum over the triangulations is now restricted to a smaller subset, which has the nice property of being associated to only pseudo manifolds. So I won't give a precise definition of pseudo manifolds, but they are just manifolds modulo some singularities, but nice ones in a sense. So for example, in 3D, there will be only point-like singularities, no extended singularities as in the original formulation. And why is that so? To comment on the point I was drawing before, it's just because the colors that are added to the to the model allow to additional data that allow to reconstruct the full cellular structure of the foams, and not only the two cell structure. So in these models, a big step ahead has been the discovery of the 1/n expansion by Razvan and Vincent and others. And so it's a specific scaling of the coupling constant lambda, so in equation 6. So you should rescale the lambda with the certain powers of the cutoff. And in this limit, when the cutoff is sent to zero, you found out that the theory is dominated by a specific sector of a specific set of triangulations, which are called Mellonic triangulations, and which have the nice property of being spheres. So not only they are manifolds, but also they have a trivial topology. So it's a nice aspect. You see that by solving the first problem I was mentioning before, that is the lack of control on the topology, you also find a regime where you solve the second problem. That is, you have a nice orderings of a nice reshuffling of the divergences of the model, so that you have a dominating sector which is given by spheres only. So now I would like to build on this 1/n expansion to present to you a class of models called the tensorial ones, which are amenable to renormalization techniques. So we would like to reproduce the 1/n expansion results via a dynamic process, in a sense. We would like to generate the scaling of the 1/n expansion by a flow given by a renormalization group of a proper field theory. So not a cutoff models, but a proper field theory. Okay. So what is the general structure I would like to talk about? So as in the Bulatov case, we have a complex field on a given number of copies of a compactly group G, and the number of copies is equal to the dimension of the spacetime you would like to randomize D. And then the dynamics is defined by first a propagator, which is encoded in a Gaussian measure d mu c with the covariance C. So C is the propagator or the second moment, if you prefer, of a Gaussian measure. And this is supposed to encode both geometrical constraints and dynamics. So for example, we will see that we will study Gaussian measures which implement Laplacian terms. And now the big S, the action S is supposed to be only the interaction part of the action, because the kinetic part has been put into the Gaussian measure. And to construct the interaction part of the action, we should decide what are the terms we allow in this model. So this is what I would like to call a locality principle. That is, by analogy with the quantum field theories defined on space times, where you require that the interactions are local and Lorentz invariants, for example. Here I would like to call local a set of interactions that you give yourself and you're allowed to use to construct the model. I will discuss now different possibilities for the locality principle and different possibilities for the Gaussian measure, and then we will choose one set of such prescriptions and see what we can do with them. So the first natural prescription for locality, as I explained already, maybe in the Bulatov model, is really that it's pretty natural to consider that to build a generic discrete spacetime, you should start from the most elementary building blocks, And these are the simplices. So to construct a d-dimensional triangulation, you should, it's pretty natural to glue together d-simplices along their faces. So in the example is in the 3D case, the tetrahedra glued together to form 3D triangulations. So as I said, there are many problems with these prescriptions, the prescription, and a way out was to add the colors, as I explained. And I would like to go a bit further. So in simple tensor models, it was even possible to remove the colors. So what do I mean by that? It was possible to consider models with colors, so with d plus one fields in d dimensions with simplification interactions, and then subsequently integrate d of the fields to obtain an effective theory giving the dynamics of one single field. And this has been called uncoloring. And what's pretty interesting is that if you start from such a color model with one single interaction, a simplicial one, and integrate all the fields but one, you obtain an effective theory with an infinite number of interactions, which are given by an invariance principle called the tensor invariance. So I will try to explain what it means. And this is the choice we will make for our locality principle. So we now start straight away from the tensor invariant interactions. And the reason why we like them is of course, because what underlies these tensor models are really colored models. Tensor invariant models are really colored models. So all the tools that have been developed in colored models are readily available. In particular, we can control the topology and the combinatorics. So we from now on we will assume that the interaction part of the model is a sum of connected tensor invariants, and these tensor invariants are labeled by so-called colored graphs. So with d colors in d dimensions, and let me explain what they are. So they are regular of valency d and bipartite edge color graphs. So what do I mean by that? Here is an example. So you have, so each vertex, black or white, is associated with one field, so either phi or phi bar, or the reverse. And each line is associated to a convolution of two variables, of two fields, along one common variable. And they are colored according to their position in the tensor. So for example, here you have one field phi, so which is represented by this white dot, and you convolute it with the black dot here along their common variables, so their common edges. So here G1, for example, is this line, G2 is this line, G3 is this line, the blue one. And then G4 and G5 are the two green lines here that go to other fields. So this is the way you construct the tensor invariants. So really, you see that the prescription is nothing but interpret the field really as a tensor, and each variable as a variable with a precise position in the tensor. So you are allowed to combine them only if they are in the same space, so in the same position in the tensor. So hence the name tensor invariance. So now we have a prescription for the interaction. We can try to look at what we could have as a Gaussian measure, so as a propagator. So usually in spinful models, we think of the propagator or the Gaussian measures as a way to implement the geometrical constraints. So when, which is common to all spinful models, is the so-called gauge invariance condition in equation 8, which is already what we had in the Bulatov model. And additional constraints in 4D, for example, will be the simplicity constraints. And so for this reason, because we interpret the propagator as implementing constraints, it's natural to assume it to be a projector. So for instance, in equation 9, this is the projector that implements the gauge inference in equation 8. But I would like to emphasize that this is not always possible. So first, because in 4D, when considering models with the non-zero with a Barbero immersive parameter, the simplicity and gauge constraints don't commute. So even if C is a combination of simplicity projectors and gauge constraint projectors, C itself is not necessarily a projector. And a second point which I would like to emphasize is that even when C is a projector, as it is the case in the Bulatov model, for example, the fact that there are divergences means that you need to introduce a cutoff, and this cutoff breaks the projector property of the covariance. And there is a very interesting paper on this point by Joseph and Valentin, which is one of the main motivations for our work, where they showed that as soon as you introduce the cutoff, if you want to analyze the divergences of the model with the renormalization techniques, you need to introduce Laplacian counterterms to take into account the fact that when you convolute two covariances with a given cutoff, you move the cutoff actually, in a sense. Okay, so and the point on which I will rely a lot is the fact that it's not necessarily bad that we cannot work with projectors, because propagators with a rich enough spectrum can be used to define a notion of scale and to start really the asking questions about how divergences can be absorbed into different portions of divergences at different scales. So really, to start looking at these models from a renormalization perspective. Okay. So here's the example we will use. So I should repeat myself a bit. So we want a model where we have a built-in notion of scale. So non-trivial propagator spectrum is a good point. And the first example we can consider is just models where we implement only the gauge invariance condition. So no simplicity constraints to start with. And so for this reason, I will consider the covariance defined in equation 12, which implements the gauge condition 10, and supplement this condition by a non-trivial covariance given in equation 11. So it's just the inverse of a Laplacian. So it's m squared plus p squared propagator, averaged over the group. So this is what is given in equation 12. So you see that the Laplacian terms give the heat kernels in equation 12, the product of the heat kernels in equation 12, integrated over a parameter alpha, which is called the Schwinger parameter. The mass introduces a decay in this parameter, so the exponential minus alpha m squared, and to ensure that the gauge constraint 10 is implemented, we average this quantity over the group by an integration over h. So h runs over SU2.
So the parameter in your heat kernel is what, the mass? Or?
Sorry,
the parameter in your heat kernel, so the temperature in your heat kernel.
So the parameter alpha is...
No,
is
alpha is the time, but there should be also some
what?
Temperature.
Or
is it the time?
So alpha is the time, and
but then you don't put u integrated by alpha, so you don't. You know, you've written just an identity notation. So you put the heat kernels as a cutoff.
Yes, in a sense, but in this point of view, not really. We just look at a model with a non-trivial propagator, and mm-hmm. as a result, it's just like a cutoff model, but integrated over the cutoff.
Ah, so the cutoff is in the propagator and the choice.
Yeah, so the cutoff will be a cutoff here on the mm-hmm. on the small values of alpha. Okay.
And then are you going to send that to zero, back to zero? Or
yeah. That's the idea. So because divergences in associated to heat kernels come only from the contributions at the identity, so coinciding points. So to ensure that no divergences appear, we just need to cut off the alpha around the value zero. Okay. So is that clear? So that's the type of model we consider. This is the propagator, and the set of interactions are tensor invariant interactions. So from now on, we are in this framework. So the amplitudes are labeled by Feynman graphs, and let me describe a bit what these graphs look like. They are d plus one colored graphs these times. This time, so the color graphs are the interactions here. So each decolor graph here, this one, and this one, are the elementary interactions in the theory. And the propagator lines are represented as a dotted lines here, or color zero lines, connecting fields with the conjugate fields here. With the conjugate. And so what I would like to say is that these graphs fully encode a too complex structure. So let me explain how. So the set of lines of the too complex are the dotted lines, so the propagator lines, so the lines that on which the group variables are supported. And a set of faces, so faces come in different kinds. They have a color. So here is the color structure I was mentioning before. And so how do you reconstruct a face here? So a face is a collection of lines, of course, of dotted lines. And the way you reconstruct them is by looking at connected set of color zero, so dotted lines. And color L lines. So this is this would be a face of color L. So let me give an example. Two examples. So here you have two lines, two propagator lines in blue, and you see that they can be connected by two additional sets, two additional colored lines of color three, so as to form a loop. So in this case, we say that we have a face formed by the two lines here, these dotted lines and these dotted lines, dotted line, and they form a face with two lines. So this is a closed space because the two lines are connected to each other to form a loop. And the second kind of face that we can have are the open faces, and it works the same. And here is an example of a face of color four, so in red. So you have this external leg, then you connect it to this line, and this way, and this way, this way, and to come back here. So is that clear? Because it's so you really need to think in terms of to understand that these color graphs are just a convenient way to encode a particular set of two complexes. So we are really talking about spin form here. So and now let's look at the amplitude. So don't need to focus too much on the details. But what I would like to say just is that the amplitude associated to a graph or to a graph G is really given by a kind of lattice gauge theory formula, where you evaluate heat kernels on holonomies associated to the faces of the two complex. And so here's again what I was saying about the link between a cutoff Bulatov like model and these models is really that you can look at these models and at this amplitude as an integral over all the Schwinger parameters associated to the propagators of regularized Bulatov amplitudes, where you replace the delta functions implementing flatness by heat kernels. So you go a bit away of flatness. Okay, and an important quantity is the incidence matrix between lines and faces, which is plus or minus one when a line is contained into a face, and zero otherwise. So this is what we will use this quantity later on. And as in usual spin form models, you have a gauge symmetry associated to the vertices of the theory, but here the vertices are really these tensor invariant quantities. So okay. Now, so as I have shown before, the amplitudes are really constructed from the incidence between lines and faces. So the lines support the elementary group variables of the from which we construct the amplitude, and the faces are associated to these heat kernels peaking around the identity. So. What I would like to say is really that, contrary to usual quantum field theories defined on space times, the amplitudes do not really depend on the relation between lines and vertices of the graphs, but on the contrary, between lines and faces of the graph. So we should think the notion of connected portions, components of a graph, in these terms, not in terms of how lines connect vertices, but really how faces connect lines. So this is what I would like to say in this slide. So we define a subgraph of a graph as a subset of lines, as usual. And now a connected component of such a subgraph is a subset of lines, which is maximally connected in the sense of the incidence between lines and faces. So what do I mean by that? It's simply that two lines will be connected if they share a common closed face. So here's an example. So here's is a colored graph with three lines and one vertex, and you can look at the graph H12 made of the line one and lines one and lines and line two, and this subgraph is a connected subgraph because you have a face running through these two lines, a common internal face. But if you take now the line L1 and L3, so I won't explain fully why, but if you look at more carefully at this example, you can notice that there is no face in the sense as defined before running through both L1 and L3. So we will say that L1 and L3 are disconnected because they don't appear in any they don't appear in common loops. So when you construct the amplitudes, these two lines are really independent. So we would like to say that they are disconnected, even if from the point of view of vertices and lines, they are connected.
Okay. So this notion of connectedness, is it stronger or weaker than the usual connectedness? I think it's, I just want to know if connectedness in this sense implies a connectedness in the usual sense.
Yes.
Okay.
Can you reduce this? I mean, is it, so really it was too complex and you want to find a new notion of connectedness. Can you somehow reduce the two complex to something one-dimensional and apply and show that it might be equivalent to some, under this map, to some normal connectedness? The jackets do that?
The jackets? I don't really understand. What do you mean by reduce?
No, I mean, so you have this, you basically have the two complex,
mm-hmm.
or even have something in higher dimensional if you
yeah.
use colors. This, I don't know if you're now with colors or without. So you have something like higher dimensional
yeah.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you invent a new notion of connectedness,
mm-hmm.
which is basically a bit higher dimensional generalization.
Yeah.
So my question, so did you try to think of a map, you know, mapping this two complex to something, just a graph?
Ah, yeah. I see.
So that the connectedness, in your sense, is mapped to connected graph.
But it could be possible, but at least in some cases, I would say.
Maybe if you take the dual,
yeah,
if you take the dual, but you have to be careful because lines are still lines in the dual, but faces now are vertices.
It seems to me more so, some dimensional reduction is
important. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure this would be always possible, no? Because
yeah, no,
it depends on the, probably if this is like somehow simply connected or whatever.
Maybe there's some mathematical subject behind it.
Ah, maybe.
Some incidents, I think it's these kinds of incidence relations.
Maybe, but the, yeah. But the point is that the properties of the incidence matrices between lines and faces are not the same as the properties between vertex vertices and lines. So,
yeah.
In some cases, it should be possible. In some. Okay, so now we have defined a notion of connectedness that is suited to the two complex setting, and as usual in renormalization, what we will need to do when analyzing the divergences is to look at high energy connected subgraph and try to interpret them as local terms, effectively seen from lower energies. So a combinatorial tool that we need to do so is the notion of a contraction of a subgraph. So think in terms of usual quantum field theories. You have some interaction process. You see it from far away. It looks like a point-like interaction. And the way you implement it from the graph theory point of view is really that you take your graph with a complex interaction and you contract it to a point. So this is what I would like to define here, but now to contract graphs in the sense of faces and lines and not vertices and lines. So we basically have a set of elementary moves that allow to delete faces in a graph. So I will spare you the details, but the net effect is really that you take a two complex, you consider a local, approximately local part, so a connected subgraph, and subcomplex, and what you want to do is really, seen from the rest of the graph, you want to delete all the internal faces in this subcomplex, and remember only about the incidence relations between the external faces, with the external faces. So I don't know. I don't think I made myself clear. But, so is it clear or not? A bit. The idea is really that we want to have a a notion of contraction which allows to consistently forget about high dimensional loops, high energy phases. So, and I won't detail this, but this is the, we have some elementary moves. When we repeat them, we can delete as many phases as we want without forgetting about the other lower energies relations. So, and this is a kind of coarse graining prescription construction. So now let's go to the SU2 model in dimension 3. I would like to give a bit more details, but not technical ones. So here's the model. So as in the Bulatov model, we consider a field defined on three copies of SU2, a complex field. And let me remind you the general structure. You have a covariance here, a Gaussian measure here, which defines the notion of propagation, and a set of interactions, which are of the tensor invariant type. So here's I for invariant. And we restrict to a finite set of invariants. And we assume the maximum valency is called Vmax. And now the covariance, I recall the formula of before. You have one heat kernel per variable associated to the field, average over a common group variable H. And now I introduced a cutoff here on the Schwinger parameter alpha, because all the divergences come from the values of alpha, which are close to zero. And okay. So an alpha, from now on, I would like to interpret it as a momentum scale, because it is really, so to speak, is really the scale at which you start cutting off spin J variables. So if you see this covariance in Fourier space, you will notice that a cutoff on small values of alpha is equivalent to a cutoff on large values of the spins. So you really cut off the high spins where divergences come from. Let me just briefly explain the main tool that we use to analyze the divergences of these models. So it's called multi-scale analysis, and it consists in two steps. First, you should decompose the Feynman amplitudes according to different layers of alpha, different slices of alpha, so different scales. So in a usual quantum theory setting, you would decompose amplitudes according to the momenta associated to the lines of the Feynman graphs. So here we'll decompose them according to the values of the spins, if you want. And in this expansion, you should replace the high divergence subgraphs that you cannot probe by simpler effective local vertices. So it's really the essence of renormalization. It's an approximation scheme where you, seen from low energies, you forget about high energy effects and try to iterate this process and to see whether the theory reproduces itself over the different scales. Okay, and then the other points are a bit technical. I don't want to speak about them. Okay, so let me give a few details about the decomposition, the multiscale decomposition. So the key idea is really to decompose the covariance, that is the propagator, as I said, into different slices of the energy, so the parameter alpha, the momentum scale. And the way you do it in practice is you fix some parameter m bigger than 1. So this has no physical meaning, it's just a tool. So you could choose a 2, 10, or anything as long as it's bigger than 1. And then you slice alpha according to slices with a geometric progression. So you would use slice alpha. So you would take a momentum scale between energy, let's say energy 2 and 4, and then between 4 and 8, and then 16. Well, whatever, you take a geometric progression of m, and you cut, you decompose the integral from the cutoff to infinity into the integral over each of these slices. So this gives an expansion with an integral i given by the power of m that you're looking at. And so the natural regularization in this formulation is really a cutoff on the integers I. So I call it rho. And what it means is just that the parameter, the cutoff gamma on alpha, that lambda of alpha that I was talking about, is really m to the power minus 2 rho here. And so if you implement this decomposition in the amplitudes, for example, associated to a graph G, you will notice that the amplitude decomposes itself into a sum over a scale attribution mu, scale attributions mu, of an amplitude associated to the scale attribution mu. And the scale attribution is really a set of integers, I, associated to each of the lines of the graph. Okay, and then when you sum over all the possible scales of all the possible lines, you recover the full amplitudes. And so the main point of the multiscale analysis is to decompose the study of the divergences into the study of the divergences at a given fixed scale attribution, and then to sum over the scale attributions. So I will just speak about the analysis of the divergences for a given scale attribution. And then the sum is the standard thing. So the interesting point, once you have decomposed the amplitude into scale attributions, is really that you can optimize the analysis of the different contributions associated to different parts of the graphs in terms of the scales mu. So it's really a physical process. You should try to decompose the graph into so-called high subgraphs here. And the high subgraphs are nothing but connected subgraphs which have internal scales, all internal scales higher than the external scales. So here's a simple example. You have a four-valent interaction with two external legs and one internal line. So, and if you assume that the scale of this line is higher than the scale of these two lines, this means that the loops that go through this line are really shrinked as compared to what you see from the external legs. So this is what I tried to sketch in this drawing. You have small loops seen from longer external legs, and so if you probe this graph through these external legs, you really what you see, you can say I approximate this one by this graph, by just this graph, where I forget about the internal faces here, which are very tiny.
So it's really that they are tiny in terms of the spin?
It's really that what it means is that seen from these lines, the holonomy associated to this individual this J line is really very close to one, so you could as well approximate this by a delta function, and then.
So the spins are very small. No, what's the other? The spins are large. No, I just want to know. So the typical spins on the internal cases. Actually, I think they are large.
Yeah. They are large compared to the, so it's really that you are very localized here.
Yeah,
so when you see from.
It's just that if you say very localized, if you translate it into a spin form, it's exactly the opposite. Because the internal stuff is large.
But yeah, if you interpret, yeah. But seen from the, if you think in terms of parallel transport, it's pretty clear what's going on, because here you have something which is not very sharply picked, and here you have something very picked around the identity.
It's,
so
yeah, it's more curvature.
Yeah,
just it's more curvature, also is large, somehow equally connected to large J.
Okay, this I won't give any detail about that. And so then once you have a decomposition in terms of these high subgraphs, you can really analyze the divergence in terms of these elementary building blocks. And the important notion, as in any quantum field theory, is the notion of divergence degree, which I noted omega. And the divergences will come only from subgraphs which have an omega strictly bigger or equal to zero. All the subgraphs which have an omega smaller than zero will give convergent contributions to the amplitudes, and only these ones will give divergent contributions, and they need to be renormalized or reabsorbed into local counter terms. So in this model, the first question we need to address is, what are the divergent graphs? So we should classify the graphs according to the value of omega. So let me call n2k the number of vertices with the given valency 2k in a subgraph H. Big N the number of external legs. Okay, and here H over T. Here it just means that you take a graph. It's a technical point. You just take a graph H and you gauge fix it. And for this, you need to introduce a tree of lines. So it's a technical point. Forget about it. And so what we could prove is that the degree decomposes into three terms. One is decaying according to the number of external legs. So this is a necessary thing. If you want a renormalizable theory, you have to have this property that when you had more and more external legs, you have less and less contributions. Otherwise, the theory will completely will be badly divergent. And then a second point is that you shouldn't have also positive contributions when you add more and more vertices of a given type. So this means that the blue coefficient here that we computed to be 6 minus 2k should be always positive. And so you see that this means that the maximum valency that you can have here to ensure that you have no positive contributions coming from here is really 6. So V should be, V max should be at most 6. So it means that we will be able to renormalize these models only up to pi to the 6 interactions. So I will explain what it is. And this factor, so it's a bounded factor. And we could prove that it's saturated for a specific class of graphs. Our graphs, which are essentially melonic, so if you know what it is, good. Otherwise, never mind. It's the specific class of graphs which are spherical. So, as I said, we need to restrict ourselves to a phi 6 theory, and if we do that, the degree of divergence takes this form, and we can fully classify the possible values of omega in terms of big N and small n's and the quantity rho I wrote before. And these are all the possible divergent graphs. So the ones where omega is zero means that they will give log divergent contributions. When omega is one, they will give linearly divergent contributions. And when omega is two, they will give quadratically divergent contributions. And so divergent subgraphs associated to a number of external legs, six or four, will be associated the renormalization of the coupling constant associated to this to interactions of degree six or four, and these graphs will be associated to two point function counterterms, and the interesting point here is that because we have quadratically divergent graphs and linearly divergent graphs here. So the fact that we have a rich set of two-point divergences means that we need a mass renormalization to absorb log divergent terms, but also a wave function renormalization to absorb these quadratically divergent terms. So and therefore, let me give you the final form of the theory, which we could prove to be renormalizable. So I wrote all the possible interactions up to order six here, and so you have a two-point interactions, four-point interactions, and three different kinds of six-point interactions. And let me just say, without proving it, that this interaction is not relevant because it doesn't generate any divergence or any graph that leading to divergences. And it's a good point because this graph is associated to a topological singularity. So if you want to have a space-time interpretations, it's good that we don't have to use this type of interactions. And then so we define the theory as follows. We have the cutoff covariance, and then we define a renormalized interaction associated to a renormalized coupling constants, so of the type 4, 6, 1, 6, 2, and not 6, 3, so the first three here. And then because of the two-point function renormalization, we need to add as well counter terms associated to the two wave function renormalizations, and they are of the following form. One is the same as the tensor invariant two-point interaction, and the second one in red is not really a tensor invariant because there is the Laplacian terms, so it should really be interpreted as a rescaling of the covariance. But because there is a non-trivial interplay between the cutoff and these counter terms, it's more practical to introduce the counter terms in the interaction part, even if you should think about them as renormalizing the coefficients in front of the Laplacians in the covariance.
So how does this result? I mean, how much does this result depend on SU2?
Not much.
So if you would have taken maybe one cube.
Easier, I would say.
But do we get the same?
Yeah, because the scalings are the same, and the crucial point actually, I didn't give any details about that, but is that the power counting I showed before is an abelian one, so that is it's really capturing all the divergences, all the structures of the divergences only when the group is abelian, okay, or when the graph is simply connected, so to speak. Uh-huh. And
so because you are simply connected,
Because
you are simply connected, it's the same.
Yeah, and because the divergences come from simply connected graphs in these models, mm-hmm, Melloni graphs, actually the divergences are the same, and we could use we could forget about all the complicated terms in the power counting of Valentin and mm-hmm, Matteo.
Yeah, I mean, right, that now was quite non-trivial among the beings.
Yeah, yeah, but the important point is that the power counting they have, mm, in the non-abelian case can always be bounded by the abelian one, and the abelian one is enough to saturate all the divergences here. So
non-abelian assumed it's a bit less divergent.
Yeah. The reason intuitively is really that when the group is non-abelian, you will have a, instead of you could have a yeah whatever you could have a instead of x plus y minus x, you would have a g h g minus
yeah.
1, which would not cancel,
yeah.
And so you will have less less pickedness around identities or something.
Yeah.
And okay, and that's it. So let me summarize a bit, just what I tried to explain today. So the main point was to say that introducing geometric constraints, which are so important in spin forms, is possible in renormalizable tensor holography theories. And there is a very interesting interplay between the constraints, the tensorial structures, and the QFT formalism. And that's what I tried to emphasize with these notions of connectedness that we need to modify, locality, and okay, and this depends on what are the dynamical degrees of freedom. So there is a rich interplay between these structures. And then I presented to you a SU2 model, which is just renormalizable in dimension 3. So now I have a few open questions that we would like to address in the future. So first, let me emphasize that tensorial group field theories are new types of field theories which deserves to be studied on their own. So in particular, we might ask questions such as is asymptotic freedom generic? So this would be interesting because that's, after all, the main reason why we introduced non-abelian quantum gauge theories. But concerning spin forms and gravity in particular, I would say that the near future things that we would like to explore is first to study a bit further this SU2 model in 3D and see whether it's asymptotically free, as it seems to be, and whether it can be related in a more concrete way to the Ponzano-Legge model. So, because we are inspired by this model, and you see that we kind of modify the Bulatov model. But the exact relationship is a bit unclear. And of course, the main point we would like to explore is the generalization of this things to 4D gravity models. And as I said here, the fact that there is a non-trivial interplay between the constraints and the structures of the QFT and the tensorial structures means that we need to analyze further the relationship between simplicity constraints and tensor invariants, find what could be the notion of scale that we used, that would replace the notion of scale we used here, which was tied to the propagator, to the fact that we had the Laplacian. And so a similar question is whether we need to add Laplacian terms into equilateral models or things like that, or whether the fact that we have non-trivial propagator is already enough to launch a scale analysis. And okay, and we want to find a renormalizable model. So, and that's it, thank you. It was a bit messy, sorry about that.
Questions? All right. About the SU2, when you renormalize, I mean, when you want to subtract now divergences and you do your interpolation mode with SU2, I think it's the right place where the SU2 group will enter. For instance, in the R merger, okay, and you will play a role there. You will have maybe difficulty. I don't know if you went through this analysis. I mean, the normalization process. So I'm sure that there the group will have importance.
It will change the values of the coefficients that you need to use, but not the structure in a sense. No?
So you would expect the same behavior.
Hmm?
You would expect the same behavior.
Yeah.
For the
well, it's not. Well, maybe that's true, but my question was, how do you perform a normalization? Okay, and how do you extract?
By the same way, you expand around local
terms.
Yes,
that's the point. That's really difficult because all your group variables, you've got parameters. Okay, so you have a bunch of parameters there. So you have to expand it, extract using it kernel expansions, stuff like this, and now you become pretty a mess. So maybe if you forget about all the structures, I'm sure that the SU2 group, because when we expand it with Valentin, for finding that propagator using SU2, if you want to remain in that level, well, you will face problems because it becomes
yeah.
So this is all, but maybe not for the power counting as you
no, mentioned. Power counting, there is no difference.
Because you just use a leaf kernel.
So do you have an idea how to make the relation to the Fonzano matching algorithm?
But it's just that naively when we, I would say it depends a bit on the flow equations, I would say, because naively if you send, for example, the mass to infinity, you are picked around the. You pick more and more the. Yeah, but on the other end, the direction of the flow is going away from the point where you have a sharp pickedness.
And the flow naturally goes to.
Yeah, because you.
G equal to zero.
Yeah.
That is what happens in that case. Always to strong coupling, and that is why I find it dangerous for heat curves.
Ah.
Because as soon as you do that, you flow immediately away from the air.
But what does it have to do with the heat curves? Because it's just the fact that the modes are
the Young Mills, basically, that is you can write a heat kernel Young Mills action. It's a different kind of heat kernel, it's because it's the heat kernel on the faces and you put it on the edges. But in any case, as soon as you cause strain in this lattice sense, what happens is that you flow towards being peaked on J equal to zero.
Yeah, you integrate out a large J.
Yeah, yeah. So you flow away from the VF.
That's why I say the interpretation is not completely clear.
Yeah.
And also we modified the type of interactions, so it's not clear that.
Yeah, it's not sufficient.
Yeah. 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 In these models, you're studying the normalization, and you have a notion, this formally a notion of high energy and low energy. And in principle, you can ask actual energies how many coupling constants you should measure to make predictions. So, how many you have here? Is it a number when you say it's normalized?
Yeah, it's the. So, we had up to 5-6 interactions. So, it was 4 or 5 interactions, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. So, 4 coupling
constants. Okay, so you have only these 4 terms. And my question is. Could have you guessed them just by simple principles or by looking at dimensions of operators? These are the ones that we are now getting theory reasoning. Or is it really a surprise that you have only these 4 or 5 terms?
No, it's not a surprise. It's the natural way you would do it in any quantum field theory. You write all the terms that are compatible with some symmetry, mm-hmm. and then you look at the power counting. But so the fact that we didn't just look at some dimensions for the power counting is just to be sure that we treat all the overlapping divergences and things like that. But otherwise, in spirit, it's the same.
Other questions? Thanks, everyone.